I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Welcome to Spoiler Alert, episode 95. I'm Duncan.
And I'm Simon.
And 1995 in cinema. Let's start with Spoiler Alert favourite, Living in Oblivion. Great film. Also, Simon's favourite superhero film of all time, Batman Forever.
Yes. I have real strong memories of going to that because I was really excited. I was pumped for it. Joel Schumacher, right? Had done Falling Down as maybe a couple of years previous. Val Kilmer was hot at the time, right?
Yeah.
Nicole Kidman had just done To Die For. Jim Carrey. You know, I mean, it was packed. It was going to be great. And this was pre-internet days, so I had no sense of what was going to happen to me. So it's probably actually the most disappointing film I've ever been to, like from a scale of like my excitement level compared to how I felt once the movie started.
Yeah,
you know, I've never had a bigger drop off.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that seem to skate by critical mauling as well, because people kind of like, it's not too bad. Like Batman and Robin got absolutely roasted, but when you will go back and watch Batman Forever, is just as bad, really. Not quite as bad. You know, Batman and Robin's seen as this absolute nadir of almost 90s cinema, not just Batman. Whereas Batman Forever is like, well, if you go back and rewatch that, it's actually,
I'm not going to do that, eh?
Okay, there's also the first part of Richard Linklater's Sunrise trilogy, which was released in 1995 before Sunrise. Who knew that was going to go on to be this kind of like 20-year, franchise, indie franchise, dueling Scottish legends Braveheart and Rob Roy, Ice Cube and Chris Tucker's Stoner Comedy Friday. Terry Zwigoff's critically lauded documentary about unique cartoonist Robert Crumb, Jean-Pierre Junot and Mark Caro's Striking the City of Lost Children, the brief moment when Alicia Silverstone was one of the biggest names in Hollywood thanks to Clueless. Do you remember that? It was just like enormous. And then she did Excess Baggage. I remember she did that movie, Excess Baggage. And she had carte blanche over everything to do with that film. She executive produced it. She could do the cast. I think Benicio del Toro's in it because she chose him, it was just amazing. And then literally after that, just gone.
It's wild, eh? That fall off is incredible. And just
because most people who do that is kind of like Julie Roberts from Pretty Woman, and then she just became this, institution in Hollywood forever since then, Larry Clark's controversy baiting Kids that starred very young Chloe Svenning and Rosario Dawson, and the film that I felt really signaled the zenith of Kevin Costner's powers, Waterworld. Speaking of, people who kind of had the absolute power at one point, Robert Rodriguez's Desperado. I mean, talk about being excited, going to see that, especially after having seen El Mariachi. Brad Pitt and Kevin Spacey went head to head in Seven. And of course, while their roles in Usual Suspects and 12 Monkeys went head to head at the Oscars, for Best Supporting Actor, and Spacey emerged victorious. Cage won his Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas, while another film set in Las Vegas swept the Razzies, Showgirls. Denzel Washington's entertaining 1940s detective film, Devil in a Blue Dress. I really like that. I'm always a sucker for a detective film. And I watched this not long ago, actually, and it's still a good watch. James Bond re-emerged after a six-year hiatus with Pierce Brosnan's belated debut, GoldenEye. Scorsese's Casino, Oliver Stone's Nixon, Ian McKellen's wicked interpretation of Richard III, which is really good, Michael Mann's still iconic Heat, and Pixar's modern classic Toy Story. Danny Boyle and Ewan McGregor, their excellent calling card thriller Shallow Grave with a really great soundtrack by Left Field, Atom McGuire's study of grief twisted through sex in Exotica, which is the first of three consecutively stunning films from the Canadian director, which I'm sure as we go through the 90s of these episodes, we'll get to. But he did this, followed by Sweet Hereafter, followed by Felicia's Journey. All of those, this Exotica slightly less so, but Sweet Hereafter and Felicia's Journey, I think, are just incredible films.
Sweet Hereafter is I love that film. I adore that film.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I genuinely think that's one of the best films of the 90s. I'll just come out, and we haven't even got to it yet, but it's just as close to perfect as you can get, I think, that film. It's so good. And look, the underrated Dolores Claiborne, the Stephen King story, with a pair of compelling performances from Jennifer Jason Leigh and Kathy Bates as the daughter fighting to clear her estranged mother's name of murder. If you haven't seen this, I recommend checking it out. Both of them are fantastic in it. And it's also got a David Strathairn in a really interesting kind of ugly character role. But this is a really good thriller. And, you know, Kathy Bates always remembered with Stephen King for Misery. But this is if you haven't seen Dolores Claiborne, I recommend checking it out. It's on a lot of streaming sites. But really good performances from both of them.
Okay, so you know how this works, folks. This is the part of the show where Duncan talks about the best films of the year, and I just focus on the best horror before narrowing my focus to one particular horror film I just really want to talk about. Well, not this time, because this is 1995, my friends, and 95 was a horror wasteland. Sure, if you want to play a bit of genre twister, you could call Seven a horror, but it was never sold as a horror. If it was, I'd have a very different story to tell you today. Instead, I'm left with a selection of films as tired as The Howling, New Moon Rising, as bereft of thrills as Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, which we've talked about before, and as laughably scare-free as Leprechaun 3. Also, as you can probably already guess, this was a year filthy with sequels, with more Candy Men and Children of the Corn, more carnosaurs, witch boards, and witchcrafts. The scariest thing about 95 was how worn out it was all looking. So with that in mind, rather than celebrating the gory glories of the year in horror, I'm going to reflect back on the shabby disappointments of 95, to wallow in the muck of a year that's best forgotten. So Clint Howard.
Easily confused.
Yeah, totally. I just saw Clint start an Ice Cream Man. The story of, well, an ice cream man who starts putting human bits in his ice creams. A real hokey pokey scenario, if you will. The film has a cultish following, I guess, for its unintentional comedy, shall we say, which encouraged Howard to start a Kickstarter a few years back to get a sequel made. So, look, he raised $4,000 towards his goal of $300,000.
Oh, that must have taken quite a chunk. $4,000 out of your savings, Simon. That's quite a lot.
I would love to invest in Ice Cream Man 2, Rocky Road to Hell, as long as my suggested title gets used.
Yeah, I could just imagine produced by Simon Lambert.
Executive producer, yeah. But like 296,000 short, so I think that's been put on ice. Three horror film royals turned out flops. Wes Craven turned Eddie Murphy into a vampire in a bad wig and Vampire in Brooklyn, remember that?
Oh, yeah, I do remember that, unfortunately.
Greasy mullet, hey?
Yeah, it was almost like it was a comedy, though, wasn't it, as well, right?
Well, I don't think it was... I'm not sure. It feels like it slipped through the cracks of what it wanted to be, and I think probably that's what was wrong with it. Apparently, Eddie Murphy took it extremely seriously, you know, because it was at the stage where I think he wanted to be, you know, a serious actor, I guess. But you don't hire Eddie Murphy if you don't expect some comedy, right? Tobe Hooper mangled the mangler. And perhaps John Carpenter fared the best of the three with a lukewarm remake of Village of the Damned, a film even he described as a contractual assignment he wasn't passionate about. So that's 95 for you, eh? It was also Christopher Reeve's final film before the horse riding accident.
That's right, yeah.
So almost by default, the winner is VHS shelf guilty pleasure Species from New Zealand director Roger Donaldson, with a cast that included, I mean, I was staggered by this, Ben Kingsley, Forest Whitaker, Michael Madsen, Alfred Molina, and an early performance by Michelle Williams.
All right. She's the...
The young Species. And some H.R. Geiger alien designs, of course. And yet all of that was overshadowed, as I remember it, by Natasha Henstridge wandering around half naked in some sort of tribute, can I call it that, to Tobe Hooper's schlocky alien invasion classic. Life Force. It's a different time, eh, man?
Funnily enough, as kind of like horrifying as the, you know, she has the sex in the bath, in the spa bath, and like kills that guy, and it's all like, you know, like frothing mess and all the rest of it. It's still not as horrifying as the sex in the bath in Showgirls from the same year, which is kind of funny.
So. You know, Showgirls is one of those films, I mean, where people talk about it as being like a camp classic and a genuinely enjoyable camp experience. Yeah. I never found it that. I found it intolerably difficult to watch.
Yeah, yeah. We've talked about this before, and it took me like two goes to get through it, and those two goes were like 6 months apart.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it took me a couple of goes as well.
Yeah, that's crazy though with Species, man. That's three Oscar winners in that film, right? So
that's an incredibly strong cast for what is a really schlocky B premise. So you attracted those guys to be in your film, you know? But yeah, 95. So I kind of, you know, as all our listeners probably know, I'm a massive horror fan. But there was a period there where I guess I went away and discovered other genres. And I'm wondering if it's because the 90s were so bad.
Yeah, yeah, you're probably right. It was a real, we're going to get to it, I'm sure, next month. But, you know, Scream really rejuvenated the horror, 90s horror, because people probably nowadays think, oh, Gen X, you know, Scream, you know, blah, blah, blah. But that was really kind of came out of nowhere. It was almost, like you say, thrillers had kind of taken over. So Silence of the Lambs or... you know, and Seven was, you know, the genuinely great films as well, not just good thrillers, but genuinely great films. So thrillers have kind of taken over, and I think that horror, 80s was the, you know, that kind of crass commercialization of horror, but it was just, you know, people were drowning in it. But the 90s was, it was almost kind of reminds me of, say, like Star Wars kind of coming out, and then everyone did science fiction films. And everyone, oh, the 70s must have just been science fiction. It's like, actually, science fiction was kind of a C-grade joke almost at that point, you know. People weren't doing science fiction films in the 70s until Star Wars hit, not seriously, and not en masse. And I kind of feel the same way with horrors. Once Scream hit, then everyone went, oh, we can do horrors again. And so between 1990 and 96, it was kind of the death of that. 90 91 92 was kind of the death of horror.
Well, there was so little original stuff coming out as well. Just so many sequels. It's ridiculous, yeah. The amount of sequels. And sequels to stuff that wasn't that great to begin with, too, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely needed an injection or something. But it's not like now where, I mean, horror coming out now all the time and it's all good. Yeah. Well, I mean, not all good, obviously, but there's always, yeah. It's pretty dependable that you're going to get a good horror coming out.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you could probably pick a year out of the last... I don't know how you'd know better than me, but say out of the last 5-6 years or whatever, and you could probably pick like three genuinely great horror films. Whereas your pick for 1995 is Species. You know what I mean? It's like says a hell of a lot from a horror aficionado. Is like, well, I don't know, like, you know,
Species.
Yeah,
it's pretty. Yeah, it's not much. It's not too great, eh?
Yeah.
Hey, so what have you been watching though more recently?
Look, I've watched quite a few films recently because, hey, we're in lockdown for everyone who's listening in the future. We're in lockdown yet again. So Simon's at his house in his little bubble. I'm at my house in my little bubble, connected by the Zoomage, kind of coming out of the tail end of winter. So the weather's not been great, been locked at home. So actually watched quite a lot. The one that I wanted to talk about was The Night of the Generals, which is from 1967. I'd never heard of this film. It's a murder mystery set in Nazi-occupied Poland, which sounds crazy, right? So Omar Sharif is a German officer investigating a woman's murder who happens to be a prostitute, and the three suspects are Nazi generals. And the key to the film is that those generals are played by Charles Grey, Donald Pleasance, and Peter O'Toole.
Wow!
Yeah. So they're politely hostile sparring pops in every scene they're in, especially the first one that they're in together. Grey is, if you don't know Charles Grey, might not be the name you know instantly, but he's from, he's appeared in a couple of Bond films. He was Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever. He's also in You Only Live Twice. Of course, he was the narrator from Rocky Horror Picture Show. So Charles Grey is smarmy charm, as you expect. O'Toole is just pure arrogance, containing a rage behind a veneer of superiority, while Pleasance is calculating and calm. This triumvirate of actors really makes the movie, while Sharif hovers on the periphery playing the Hercule Poirot to this rogues gallery. It's his principled approach to the duties of police investigation that makes him an unusual protagonist, because he is a Nazi, and we're never clear where the boundary of his beliefs lie. So a screenplay written by Gore Vidal and Goldfinger co-writer Paul Den is bound to enjoy some wicked laughs, and this is shot through with black humor, both in quick-witted dialogue, but also brutal absurdism, almost reminiscent of Apocalypse Now. Particularly chilling is the shot of O'Toole watching over his destruction as his flamethrowers just ignite a building behind him. He's like standing on top of this tank, and it's just such a genuinely reminded me of Apocalypse Now. I was like, whoa, that's a striking shot. Just because of O'Toole, you know, the way that he looks as well. This is, you know, this is only about 5 years after he did Lawrence of Arabia, which actually explains why both O'Toole and Sharif are in this film. They felt indebted to the filmmakers because they were producers of Lawrence of Arabia, which made them stars, and they got kind of roped into this. I don't think either of them particularly, especially O'Toole, I don't think he particularly wanted to do this film. Added to it, there's almost like a Dr. Strangelove level of insanity to investigating a single murder among literal genocidal acts. I mean, this is in Poland, like Nazi-occupied Poland, and they're investigating one woman's murder. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you only need to look at the clearing of the Polish ghettos and something like Schindler's List to go, well, okay. But the film has an unusual plot structure, meaning Sharif is out of the story for large chunks. The movie takes an unadvised second act turn to focus on the Valkyrie plot to overthrow Hitler. And the first act's tightening of the net is really sacrificed in this, unfortunately. And it's just got an inconsistent, unnecessary framing device that's set in 60s Poland. But the film's gallows, pitch black humor, and the rogues gallery of performances mean this is an unusual film that's worth a watch. I really like Pleasance in this. He was really good. Peter O'Toole is just, you know, if you want to cast an Aryan, you know, guy, is like, you know, he really is. And actually has quite a lot of Hitchcockian moments as well, especially O'Toole. Reminded me a little bit of late Hitchcock, say 60s or Frenzy era Hitchcock. So it's a really unusual film worth checking out for anyone who is interested in it.
Mm. I have heard of this, but I haven't seen it, and you're the first person to talk to me about it. So yeah, I'd bump that up my list based on that.
And what about you, Simon? What have you been checking out?
Well, look, I'm shocked it took me 6 years to get around to watching the Polish mermaid film, The Lure. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
But I finally caught up with it during the lockdown. And I don't know what I expected. I hadn't read much about it. But I'd always been kind of fascinated by the poster of this mermaid floating in a bath. It's an enormous scaly tail draped over the porcelain rim. I think I thought it would be a horror, so therefore right up my alley. And it was, you know, in parts. It definitely gets gooey at times, but I didn't expect it to be mostly a musical.
Okay.
You know, somehow I wasn't prepared for that. So it opens with two mermaids drawn out of the water at night by what I still assume to be a family, a couple and their teenage son, who are singing and playing music by the lakeside. Almost immediately, we cut to the family, now performing at a club, which we'll be seeing for most of the rest of the film. They've taken the mermaids who transform into human girls when away from water, just minus some normal human lower body parts, if you know what I mean. Once the club owner sees the girls splash with water, transform into mermaids, he lets them stay, realizing they have an impressive stage act. The five-piece are a bit of a sensation, but their success is complicated when one of the mermaids falls hard for the teenage son, while the other mermaid gives into her wild, more beastly nature. So yeah, that's The Lure, and I liked it quite a bit. Though it's a case of a film of great moments and sometimes striking visuals rather than something that works great as a whole. I love the horror genre, obviously, and musicals as well. So I guess I was always primed to like this. But the musical side of it's a little bit odd. It mostly takes place in the real world, so on stages or at a club they work at. So the musical numbers in the actual world of the characters that taking part that the people in the film can hear. But there's several more fantasy numbers that exist in the world outside of the characters, and that's fine in itself. But at least one song goes all the way with, you know, extras leaping around and doing splits and turning the whole thing kind of Busby Berkeley, you know, which felt weirdly out of place for me.
Yeah.
And the rest of the film where it's clear that the music is being performed. There's a moment where one of the mermaids says, "We never go out and we never have money and yet all we do is work." And I thought, too right. How is any of this film working? Like, why aren't real mermaids who can sing and dance like a bigger thing? They should be international celebrities, right? Which means I can only assume that in the world of The Lure, mermaids are rare perhaps, but not unique. But then how does this club work? It seems a little like a burlesque deal with occasional nudity, but it doesn't feel big enough to support a five-piece act with enough audience members to pay for it. But I guess I shouldn't be questioning this stuff. And I probably only was because the middle section got a little bit woolly and lost, and I found myself thinking about how this entire world would work, you know? There's powerful moments, to be sure. There's a scene where the family break into shattering violence, followed by the aftermath, shot in a kind of a wandering single-shot take that finds their bodies splayed all over the apartment like the results of a nuclear blast. It's kind of fantastic. And there's a surgical procedure that leans on the right side of surreal for me, with a doctor and scrubs slow dancing around between two operating tables. But it's clear to me that the middle of this film is messy. One of the mermaids has a scratch on her cheek, which we see her receive later in the film. And while it would be generous of me to sort of put that down to some sort of Pulp Fiction styles narrative leapfrogging, it seems more likely the decision was made in the edit suite that this scene should go earlier and, right, you know, the audience will just have to live with it. Perhaps 90 minutes was all just a bit much for the lure, because while it hit some high notes along the way, it's the open and the finish that hit the hardest. The ending, fully embracing the myth of the mermaid to kind of tragic and brutal effect, will actually stick with me for quite a while. Right. Like I said, it's a lot. There was a lot to like for me. It's surreal, funny, sad, and almost, and kind of most importantly, unique. And as I've said before plenty of times, weird can be its own kind of good. And combine that with a genuinely gorgeous style and a pretty great last 10 minutes. And like, as I've said before, good endings, as I've always maintained, do so much to lift a film in my estimation. So yeah, it's an experience I can kind of recommend. I mean, if you, what you're looking for is a Polish musical mermaid film with a bit of gore.
Aren't we all?
Oh, totally, eh? How often? Back in the day, you're at the video store, you're asking the guy behind the counter, have you got any Polish mermaid films? not that one. I want something with a bit of gore.
Yeah, so have you checked out the Polish mermaid shelf over there?
Yeah. A whole shelf of one film.
Yeah, that's right. It's behind the curtain. Classic. Oh, that sounds, that's very unusual.
Yeah, I remember when it came out, it was at the festival, and I didn't get along to it, but I remember the poster, and I probably circled it as one of those films I wanted to go to and never, you know.
Yeah, sounds a bit like Shape of Water styles.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, that imagery certainly felt similar.
Tell me, General, is it true that in the Battle of Leningrad you used frozen bodies instead of sandbags for your artillery?
The story is exaggerated.
Some soldiers lie and rot in the battlefield. I thought it most imaginative, putting the dead to work, you might say.
Nobody rots with me.
Okay, and now it's time for the second half of our 10 years of spoiler alert. So, Duncan, you've compiled a list from, what, episode 45 on, I guess?
Yes. This is my ones I've curated, as they say these days.
Hand-picked.
Organic, garden fresh. This was good going back. Simon obviously picked from the first 45, and I picked from the second, and I'd forgotten some of them, some good rants in there.
I'd forgotten how much I hate, how angry I was about Scott Eastwood.
I love how fascinated you were by Livewire, the Pierce Brosnan film.
Just listening back to you talk about it, and I still haven't seen it, obviously, but hearing you talk about it again made me think, man, why have I not watched Livewire? It sounds brilliant. Better than number 23, which I'll probably never see.
Oh, yeah, number 23. Yeah, that's a bad film. So it's good to revisit the history of Spoiler Alert. So here's on to part two.
Spoiler Alert.
Look, I'm going for a bit of a Christmas theme here. And for various reasons, I've been subjected to a whole lot of Christmas movies this month. Mm-hmm. And like a famous Dickensian grump, it's made me go all humbuggy on the genre. It's not that I'm inherently anti-Christmas or that I hated all the movies I watched. Heck, I've got a soft spot for the whimsy of Elf. And Fred Claus, despite being truly horribly wrong-headed in execution, has a great concept and kind of a decent cast too. But what gets my Christmas goat is the message of Christmas movies. All of them, each and every glittery, snowbound one of them, has the same message to hawk. You have to believe in Christmas. If Tim Allen is going to get his Mrs. Claus into Santa Claus 2, or if Will Ferrell is going to save Christmas in Elf, then cynical, cold-hearted folk like you and me need to get in the Christmas spirit and start believing in a fat, ageless man in a flying sled who whirls around the world on Christmas Day, somehow managing to sneak into every child-filled house on the planet and deliver them presents. That's ridiculous.
Yep.
That's obviously ridiculous. And I know what you're thinking right now. It's just a movie. It's a kid's movie, and you happily accepted werewolf policemen, alien bloodsuckers, and the power of the Force this month alone.
But the difference is that Christmas movies are peddling a dangerous message. They're peddling the message that kids need to ignore reality and trust their hearts. Simply believe whatever the hell they want to believe. And thrust logic to one side, because logic is somehow inherently evil and bad. Again, this wouldn't be quite so bad, though it is, I believe, pretty bad, if they didn't use an orchestrated lie that parents choose to tell kids as evidence. The whole innocent-seeming argument boils down to believe what you want, don't trust rational thought, and hey, here's a widespread cultural lie to back it all up. So onto the Christmas tree of woe Christmas films, like a tawdry angel of wrong-headedness, let me impale you on the tippy top of the highest branch where you can spend the festive season suffering for your child-deluding sins.
Fantastic rant, fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it really annoys me.
A good Christmas themed, I can imagine, you know, up there with the fairy lights on the tree of woe there.
Yeah, hey, by the way, if you've got kids listening to this podcast, they shouldn't have.
Yeah, well, we did say, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
That also reminds me of, I think it's The Miracle on 42nd Street.
Sure.
Or 34th Street, I can't even remember which one it is. But in that, they put Santa Claus on trial, basically. Because he turns up and they're like, well, this guy claims to be Santa Claus and blah, blah, blah. And they get off it. They basically win the case by pointing at a dollar bill that says, "In God we trust." And they say, well, it says, "In God we trust," and we can't prove that God exists. So, hey, he gets off. And they're like, "You're right." And I love that they had to go to money and God tied into Santa Claus. It's just it's just hilarious. But it's not like a satirical film. It's like this childhood your favorite.
I always remember making a promo for the movie Loch Ness, the one with Ted Danson.
Yeah.
And he's a scientist and he goes to Loch Ness to find the monster, and this kid says to him, and God help me, I used it in my promo. he says to this kid, he says, "I've got to see it before I believe it." And the kid says, "No. First you believe it, then you see it."
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the message of a lot of of kids' films. And it's a terrible message.
It is.
Spoiler alert.
Speaking of old news, about 4 years ago, I talked in the spoiler alert news section about a proposed adaptation of Dante's Inferno. It seems that memories are short, as it is back on the cards, but everyone seems to think this is a new idea. Following the narrator, Dante himself, as he travels through all the levels of hell. Limbo, lust, gluttony, greed, anger, heresy, violence, fraud, treachery, and Sandler. There is talk about splitting the nine circles into three films, and keeping with modern filmmaking, no doubt the final circle will be split into two films itself. The film is pitched as an epic romance mixed in with supernatural action as Dante fights through hell for his love. So basically, what dreams may come meets the raid.
Cool. That's a hell of a pitch. I'm in.
Yeah.
I went from zero interest to, with your last part, like, you should have been in the pitch meeting, because I just went from zero interest to, like, 100% commitment.
Yeah.
To, like, on the air.
Yeah.
On opening day, buying a ticket.
I think as an executive, I've just made my, you know, I've justified my car park space with that meets.
That and Zach Galifianakis as Captain Caveman.
Yeah. Now I can just, like, sit in the spa pool smoking cigars for the rest of the day.
Your work is done.
Well, our movie of the month, Trainwreck, shares a terrible thing in common with The Dark Knight Rises. Both had screenings that were targeted by gunmen. And in the wake of these increasing shootings in America, there was talk about proportionally increasing security in US cinema chains. A statement by a consumer insight group, C4, was chilling in its corporate speak and more than a little passive-aggressive, saying that moviegoers would pay extra for security because they'd value their safety the same way they value 3D or IMAX. But the large US cinema chain Regal says that their security measures would fall short of metal detectors but go to bag checks. So if you have a gun tucked into your shorts, no problem. Simply avoid carrying a bag. But it's the cost that has dictated the headline news. Front and center, from the advisors to the chains to the media, is the news that it may cost between $1 or $3 more in the US to purchase a movie ticket. To have your bags checked by people who, and as a former employee of a major cinema franchise, I can speak from experience here, have absolutely no idea what they're doing when it comes to reading a crowd. Hell, it's difficult enough to even stop people from taking hot food into a theater. I don't know how you're going to stop them taking guns in there. Adding to the arbitrary nature of the discussion is the news that, apparently, 46% of people are happy paying $1 more for their ticket for enhanced security, while only 19% of that same people are happy to pay $3 more. So assuming the surveyed person thinks that these measures are effective, they value $2 more than their own lives. This would seem to a plebeian like me to also lead the cinema chain down a path of irreversible escalation of security as the years progress and the crimes continue, but also one of implied responsibility when an incident does occur. If you're explicitly paying for security and they fail to protect you, then it would seem like they are derelict in duty. But then again, these chains are canny enough to protect themselves, if not the cinema goer they're planning to overcharge for meaningless searches. The crazed gunman may be low-hanging fruit for the tree of woe. So instead, I'll say what should be rational, clever responses, but instead turn out to be poorly thought-out, knee-jerk reactions to crazed gunmen will be spending time on the tree, enough time to think of better solutions to this worrying and violent situation.
Man, I'm so glad that we live in the country we do.
I know. It's just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
But unless you put metal detectors in there, I don't know how anything else. And then you're also going into this profiling thing. They were talking about the popular news now, Straight Outta Compton, is number one in the States for a couple of weeks running. And apparently Universal agreed to put extra security on showings. Now, to me, that's a kind of a profiling of a culture.
It totally is, isn't it?
And there, as far as I know, there certainly has been incidents where people are walking in shooting 12 people.
Yeah, because let me ask you, if you were to let's profile a movie, a romantic comedy starring Amy Schumer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't pick that, would you? I mean, if you were to be...
No. I mean, even The Dark Knight Rises, you might get some liner. They had an incident, Mad Max Fury Road. But apparently that guy didn't even have a gun. He had like a machete and some mace spray or something.
Right.
So it's like, well, where does it end, you know? It
probably wasn't even mace. It was probably that silver spray.
That silver spray. Yeah. Oh, what a lovely day.
Yeah.
That was probably that. Yeah.
Just witnessing.
I saw Livewire. Pre-Bond Pierce Brosnan plays an on-the-edge explosive expert on the trail of assassins. This film is bonkers. Cheaply made, with Brosnan laying bare all the issues I have with his later Bond films, which is he knows he's in a silly film, but can't resist putting in teary drama. I mean, he's in a film about people who spontaneously combust due to unknowingly drinking liquid dynamite fed to them by dead-eyed psycho Ben Cross, who's dressed like Will Ferrell in like the Night at the Roxbury skit from SNL.
And yet, I sense you're making fun of this film, but it's sounding amazing.
Yeah. But yet Brosnan has flashbacks to the drowning of his child that he feels responsible for. So all this insanity is happening around him, and he's kind of like, yeah, but I've got this, you know, my character's really got to go through this arc. It's like, dude, you know, it isn't quite so bad, it's good, but it's damn close. And mainly when people turn into like a human bomb, like that transformation is just like real good B-grade fun. They start bleeding from the eyes and everything. And it is quite funny.
You are actually totally selling me on this film.
You should hunt it out, Livewire.
Livewire.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I probably won't end up seeing Trumbo, but I'll end up seeing Livewire.
Look, many of the doctors on this list are strange, odd people working in creepy, nefarious locations. But the next one I've chosen is a regular surgeon going about his rounds in a public hospital. Dr. Lexus is a fine medical man. From his positive greeting...
Hey! Hazang, essay.
To his modesty.
Don't want to sound like a dick or nothing.
To his sound diagnosis.
It says on your chart that you're fucked up. You talk like a fag and your shit's all retarded.
He offers specific and precise remedies.
What I do is just like, you know what I mean? Like.
And displays a sympathetic connection with his patients.
Don't worry, Skrull. Now, there are plenty of tards out there living really kick-ass lives.
And even offers anecdotal evidence of others who have risen above their affliction.
My first wife was tarded. She's a pilot now.
But even someone of his caliber is confounded by a unique symptom.
Where's your tattoo? Why don't you have this?
Fantastic.
That was my Idiocracy, which seems very salient to have at the moment.
Yeah, obviously referenced it at the opening.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a great... I kind of feel it's a funnier film to talk about and reference than it is to actually watch, but it's still pretty funny.
Yeah, we've said this before, but that is like a two-minute clip of Justin Long. It's still the best thing I've ever seen Justin Long do in my life.
Totally. But look, being hardened and seemingly unemotional isn't the same thing as blandness, of course. Which brings me back to The Fate of the Furious. And one more thing I hated about that film. The team doesn't need, and we certainly don't need as viewers, Scott Eastwood. It's tolerable at the start when he's a by-the-books lackey of Kurt Russell, and everyone hates him, as much as we do as viewers. But when at the end of the film, everyone's clinking beer bottles with him and giving him those little approving, you know, you done good kid kind of nods, you know?
Yeah.
It's positively infuriating. I know there's a good-looking white guy-shaped gap in the team roster at the moment, but Scott Eastwood isn't the answer. In fact, I can't think of any question aside from what do you get when you dull Clint Eastwood down by about 200%, where Scott Eastwood is the answer. In this film, he's Poochie in a Porsche. He's Ricky Nelson singing with the Duke and Dean Martin by the fireside in Rio Bravo. And what's even worse, you just know that he's going to be in Fast and Furious 9.
Well, as a fellow Eastwood, I'd like to lead to his defense, but I'll defer to you on that one.
You can't, man. No. You can't. Look, as a fellow Eastwood, just remember how great his dad is.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's interesting to hear both of those. Fate and the Furious struck me as that just from seeing the trailers. Even the poster, it just felt like a CGI.
Oh, look, kind of totally blandness. And there's something else, and I feel weird even saying this, but at this point, no one can be hurt in a car. If you're inside of a car, at one point, people drive around in a car and park their cars around a guy to block him from a fireball because cars are invulnerable. If you're in a car in this movie franchise, you can drive off buildings and cliffs and get hit by 1,000 rounds of rocket fire or whatever.
Mm.
And yet this is a franchise established by a man who died in a car because he was driving it too fast. And I find that, how do you justify that in a way? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
At some point, there's got to be real-world repercussions in this film.
Yeah. It's kind of tone-deaf, isn't it, really? To reality.
To its own history. And its own, it's amazing to me. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have action films where people are taking risks and doing exciting things and put in jeopardy. But there's no jeopardy in this film with these characters.
Yeah.
Certainly not while they're driving a car.
Yeah.
Anyway, my rant's over.
It was cinema's unofficial 10th circle of hell, where the outlandish, the childish, the pedantic, the obsessive, the cruel, the petty, and the hilarious collided.
You're talking about a podcast.
It was the IMDb message boards, and it was glorious. A hive of scum and villainy, but with one Death Star-style precision hit, it was eradicated. Yes, the IMDb message boards were an elegant weapon from a less civilized age. As dark as the mines of Moria and populated with even bigger trolls. But boy, was it fascinating. I was never much of a poster there. In fact, I probably hadn't posted anything on a board for a good 6 or 7 years. But it was fun reading some of the geek battles on Star Wars pages, the ham-fisted attempts of trolls on Ingmar Bergman's page, and the flummoxed response of the Swedish Legion's unprepared serious fans when they're like going after wild strawberries or something. The outrage went only after a week of release. The Dark Knight became IMDb's number one rated film above Godfather and Shawshank Redemption. And lately, watching the bitter DCU fans spiral into anger at the critical annihilation their movies were receiving and the smug, sometimes patronizing MCU fans goading them. All of this happening at the rate of a new post every minute. Instead, IMDb's boards are now frozen in time, like the insect in the amber at the beginning of Jurassic Park, fossilized for eternity until some mad scientist hacker can release its potential. So go and check those pages out. Like visitors at a museum, you'll be able to comfortably see these fierce, extinct beasts without the danger of them attacking you. And while, as an empathetic, rational human being, I appreciate and even commend IMDb closing these boards down for the very reasons of not cultivating negativity or fostering bullying. So like the Colosseum, it needed to be shut down. But also, the Joaquin Phoenix Caesar from Gladiator side of me wants these same moderate, conscientious, and responsible IMDb administrators to hang from the tree of woe to be pecked at by the vultures in the same way its posters pecked away at each other for my entertainment.
Oh, man. Okay. Yeah. You know, I'm saddened by the demise of the IMDb message boards, and I know that, I mean, they're a terrible place. They are hell. It's the places you go, along with YouTube comments, really, to find the ugliest people.
Yeah.
On the internet, a place where even the most genial comment could lead to a thread of vicious name-calling, homophobic slurs. I mean, every film inevitably has a topic called worst film ever. and I'm going to miss them because while they were the ugliest place on the internet, they were also a great place to find a snapshot of what people thought about film. And every now and again, a question would get asked and answered in a civil way, much to your shock.
Yeah.
Particularly if you're a fan of older films, actually, that would work out. And if you had an unusual question, chances are someone on the IMDb boards was wondering the very same thing as you and might even have the solution. So, look, just to prove this, I mean, because I was dismayed or shocked or saddened or, you know, and I can understand why they blocked, but why that stopped. But I popped on to have a look at the boards for The Mark of Zorro because I had it sitting there to watch and found an insightful discussion about the various versions of the Zorro story. discussion I'm never going to find anywhere else.
Yeah.
Except on those boards. And sure, people will continue to chat on IMDb social media, on Facebook or something, but it won't be easy to find those conversations.
No.
You know, to search them out. Surely, hopefully, it'll be less abusive. It's got to be, right?
I know. This is so fantastic. You just go through and you have a look, and there will be comments. And like you say, you know, like worst picture ever or overrated.
Another one. Yeah. So,
you know, if you went to, you know, like Batman vs Superman, of course, you could have a field day, just sit back and watch the carnage like it's a Mel Gibson film.
Yeah.
But so the more obscure the film, the better I found those boards. Yes. The more useful I found those boards.
Yeah. I would often. I'm surprised thinking back on it how often I went there to find out stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like if I knew I was asking an unusual question, or if it was a film I've seen and I wanted to know if people were bothered by the similar thing that I was bothered by.
Yeah.
I'd go to the IMDb boards. That'd be the first place to find it.
Yeah. Now you just have to come to me. Yeah. And then you say, what do you mean you haven't seen this obscure Spanish horror? Duncan, watch this obscure Spanish horror from the 50s, and then tell me what you think if you agree with
me. And then you'll just say, it was the worst film ever.
Yeah.
All right, well, gimme a sequel to Mamma Mia. Or if you've ever heard me talk about this film before, please don't give me the sequel to this horrible 2008 hit that has just been confirmed, because I hated this film. Hated it. Hated the weak story. Hated the weak singing and dancing. By actors who could do neither of these things well. And in Pierce Brosnan's case, just horribly. Nonetheless, Mamma Mia, here we go again. A title the equivalent of a shrug and a roll of the eyes while guiltily pocketing the millions this film will make. We'll be here next year. Everyone is back. So yeah, looks like we'll get to hear Brosnan, Skarsgård and Firth butcher some more ABBA songs. Which leads me to the one big question I have about this film. How many ABBA hits are left to shove into the plot? Mm. Will they need to write in a new character named Fernando? Will there be a Napoleon War recreation scene? Can they set it at New Year's Eve so they can sing Happy New Year? I don't know. I almost want to watch the film to find out. But nothing can actually make me do that.
Well, of course, the thing is that it was a box office smash, right?
It was huge.
It was huge. So, you know, the winner takes it all, you know?
Oh.
Did they use that song in there?
They already have it.
Okay.
I'm
sorry. I'm really sorry for that.
No. It was a good call. I would have said it if you didn't, if I'd have thought of it.
My wife and I, we visited Cafe Zoetrope, which is Francis Ford Coppola's cafe, which is located on kind of the street level entrance on the bottom floor of the Columbus Tower. It almost has like those vintage style sliver buildings that you get on the corners, and it's cased in that striking kind of copper green flat iron style. It's really, really striking. Lucia, my wife, and I were sitting having a nice, very strong cocktail each, and in walks Francis Ford Coppola and sits down on the table right next to us. And he's chatting away to friends who are dining there, and we eavesdrop basically for a couple of hours and listen to him talk about everything from like Vietnam to Trump to baseball. He had bought a baseball ground because his theory was that the future of sport was men and women competing each other against each other in sports. And obviously they couldn't do something physical like, you know, rugby or, you know, things like that. So baseball was one that he thought that they would. So that was his future project.
Wow.
Yeah. This other guy came in and he was an old gentleman and he was a writer. Coppola's like, what have you been up to? And he's like, oh, well, I haven't seen you for a few months, but put a script in with, you know, your production company basically. And they turned it down. He's like, oh yeah, okay. But then this guy started talking about how he had done some location hunting with Dennis Hopper in 1980 for Out of the Blue. I was sitting there and I was like, I used to have Out of the Blue on like VHS that I bought from like the warehouse for a dollar or something. So I was like, I know this film. Coppola had no recollection of the film whatsoever. He's like, oh, I don't know that one. I was like, dude, you'd worked with Hopper on Apocalypse Now and you're not watching his directorial effort. But so this guy started telling the story. He asked about this girl and blah, blah, blah. And she, you know, midway through the film, she gets the dynamite. And then Coppola just stops the guy and he goes, how does she get dynamite? So what do you mean? And he's like, well, dynamite's a hard thing to get your hands on. Like a teenage girl's not going to be able to get a hand of dynamite. No, she shouldn't get a hand of dynamite. She should get gasoline. Gasoline's easy to do if she wants to set fire and blow something up. And so he started changing this whole thing for this film that's like nearly
30
years old. It was brilliant. And I was just blown away by that. And it was great. And and he was talking about some actor that he, I really want to know who he was talking about. They used their first name, but I couldn't remember. And he was like, oh, yeah, he's a bit intense. I didn't enjoy working with him kind of thing. And I can't remember remember who it was, maybe Christopher or Alex or someone like that. So there was lots of things like that. And it was just, honestly, it was great listening to him chat. And we ended up having dinner there. And as we left, my wife and I went up to him and said, excuse me, Mr. Coppola. It's like, thank you very much. You got a lovely place here. And, you know, and he said, looked at us both, said, thank you very much. Have a nice night. And, but it was great. There was people coming in to the place. And he was sitting there and there was this family looking at the menu, which was on this kind of podium in the entrance. And they were looking, seeing if there's anything to eat. And he goes, hey, where are you from? And they're like, oh, we're from Sweden. And he's like, oh, well, welcome to America. And they're like, thank you very much. And then they just went back to, they obviously had no idea who he was.
Yeah.
It was kind of like about 7 at night by the time we were leaving. And I was just walking on air, basically, listening.
I imagine.
Yeah. And I mean, he sounded really content. You know, he sounded like a really content guy. One guy, he said, oh, I'm going away for a couple of months. I'm going down to North Carolina or somewhere like that. And he was, he said, oh, the guy said, are you going to do some work? He said, oh, I don't want to do any work. I'm just going to relax. Like I say, he's won a couple of Palme d'Ors. He won an Academy Awards. He did The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. Like, he didn't seem like he needed to do anything more.
Yeah.
And he was just happy to enjoy himself. And another Cannes Film Festival, another Lars von Trier rampage of controversy. Von Trier said, I do know a bit about psychopaths. I've never killed anyone myself. If I do, it will probably be a journalist. He also said that it's quite important not to be loved by everybody, because then you've failed. I'm not sure if they hated the film enough, though. If it gets too popular, I'll have a problem. And, of course, he's talking about his film, The House That Jack Built, which was decried as vomitous and pathetic. And it has mass walkouts while others clapped at its finish. The trailer is about as confronting as trailers get. And my suspicion is that von Trier isn't at the height of his powers when he confronts subjects too literally. Nymphomaniac was less a film about sex rather than a critique of his own film career.
Yeah.
But it was also not as enchanting as Melancholia or as disturbingly haunting as Antichrist. I like him gambling with narratives, dancing with ambiguity and building up to shocks. Making films about nymphomaniacs and serial killers feels like a pastiche of the Danish wild man, not vintage von Trier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought this was kind of classic Cannes, really.
Oh, look, totally. I remember when we did Nymphomaniac. I remember the photo shoot we did for Nymphomaniac, too, by the way. But I remember...
I'm sure everyone else does as well. Okay, I can't forget it, no matter how hard they try.
Good Lord. But I remember feeling like it was almost a parody of, like, someone was doing a ripoff of Lars von Trier at the time. And but the thing about this news story I love is all these people are outraged, like, wow, what a hot take. You're outraged by a von Trier film.
Yeah, that's right.
Have you never seen a von Trier film? The idea that you would be shocked and find it risible or vomitous or whatever is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Harden up.
Yeah. Well, for work, I watched the 2007 Jim Carrey thriller, The Number 23.
Oh, I've never seen it.
Yeah, well, keep it that way. The Number 23 has many problems. One is it got Joel Schumacher on an off day, which is a brutal place to be sometimes. The other is he cast Jim Carrey in a noir thriller where he has to talk in hard-boiled detective speak, you know, play a saxophone sexily, and seduce platinum blonde femme fatales. You'll find Lloyd Christmas from Dumb and Dumber more seductive. But none of this film is really woe-worthy, except for one factor. Number 23 is just another example in a much personally despised subgenre for me of thrillers that is the lead character is delusional and doesn't realise he is the murderer. Subgenre. Spoiler alert for Number 23.
Well, I might be watching it now.
As is always the case, I have to preface this rant by saying there are some good examples of this, but there are infinitely more poor examples of it. In its worst manifestations, it makes my blood boil. Mostly I feel cheated and disappointed. Sometimes it is just the height of laziness. The other egregious example of this was Secret Window with Johnny Depp, where it was so obviously the twist that I had guessed it within half an hour and then spent the next half an hour talking myself out of this because it was too obvious, only to be bitterly disappointed to be proved correct. I jumped to this conclusion, much like the Office Space jumped to conclusions, Matt, but with only one conclusion drawn on the mat instead of nine, and it was replicated in The Number 23. It's one of those cinematic Rorschach tests. What is your favourite subgenre of thriller? It would take me a long time, but eventually someone would answer the delusional lead character not realising he's the villain subgenre. And then, like Mr. Glass setting fire to buildings and bombing trains, I would have found my arch enemy. So onto the tree of woe with you, lead character who suffers from delusion. And when you find yourself up there, I'm sure you'll spend your time thinking it was your partner or your rival or your boss or the neighbour or me was responsible for hoisting you up there. But just before the vultures start to peck away at your flesh, you'll have the epiphany that you actually nailed yourself up there upon the tree of woe.
Oh, nice one, nice one. My favourite subgenre of thriller, probably those ones that Shannon Tweed did back in the 80s. Do you remember there was a phase, and it's all down to 90s probably, actually.
Yeah.
But it was all down to Basic Instinct. Yeah. And that came out, suddenly erotic thrillers were big.
Yeah.
And there was, I can remember the video store in Milford actually had a shelf just for erotic thrillers.
Nice.
So, you know, not hardcore enough to have to go behind the curtain to get. Yeah. But just out there, just a little slither of like, and starring Shannon Tweed and I don't know who else.
A little sliver of sliver. Sliver was there, wasn't it?
And she's got a lot to answer for, Sharon Stone. Yeah. But it was a brief like surge of interest in those films, eh?
Yeah. They were the real kind of B-grade versions of them.
Yep.
I mean, I have a real enjoyment out of watching late 80s, early 90s, particularly early 90s thrillers. And kind of those ones, you know, the not so much Basic Instinct, but all the ones that kind of followed because of it or around that time, they're really worth checking out if you get a chance, because they're just preposterous.
Yeah.
Like Final Analysis. And Jade.
I've never seen Jade.
Oh, I kick back and watch Jade. Pacific Heights is a classic.
Oh, I know you're a big fan of Pacific Heights.
I'm not a big fan. My wife loves Pacific Heights for some reason. She loves it because it was described as the first eviction thriller. And she was fascinated by it. And Pacific Heights is a very wealthy, super wealthy place in San Francisco. I mean, it's nuts how expensive that is. So it always bothered me. Once I actually went there and it's like, this is Pacific Heights? This is like, you know, really expensive place. Mm-hmm. And this is first time buyers. Oh, we're just buying Pacific Heights. That's a real thing that bothers the hell out of me in thrillers. And if I see it again, I'm gonna blow.
Okay. So I've already talked about this on the Spoiler Alert Facebook page, but I'm going to go through it again, mostly because it amuses the hell out of me. But here's a film-by-film primer on the Halloween franchise, okay? So the first Halloween came out in 1978, followed by a sequel 3 years later that picked up on the action immediately after the end of the original. Halloween 3 came next, and it had nothing whatsoever to do with the first two films and would never be referenced by the films followed. It's a complete outlier. Though, weirdly, ideas in that film did kind of bleed into some of the sequels, even if none of the narrative does. Halloween 4 came out 10 years after the original, naturally ignoring Part 3, and was followed by the woeful Parts 5 and 6, which continued the storyline. Then Halloween H2O, as it's sometimes referred, came out in 1998, bringing Jamie Lee Curtis back after being out of the story since Part 2. It also ignored Parts 3, of course, through to 6, effectively making it a straight sequel to Part 2. This was followed by Halloween Resurrection, which proved to be anything but a resurrection, killing of Jamie Lee Curtis's Laurie Strode, and the franchise at the same time. So if you're still following all this, Halloween would be rebooted, inevitably, in 2007 by Rob Zombie, who would provide a sequel 2 years later, which leads us to now, the 2018 Halloween, which says, to hell with all that noise, but get those other 9 films. This is the one true sequel to the original Halloween. I mean, that is the most messed up film franchise timeline ever, eh? I can't think of a film franchise that does something like that.
Yeah. Let me lead off my review by asking you, the viewer and listener, a question. What are you reasonably expecting from a 40-year-old horror franchise on its 11th installment, a series that has 2 films called Halloween 2, and this is the 3rd film in the series called Halloween?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's 11 films, but 5 of them are basically 2 titles.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I kind of expect not to see Busta Rhymes.
Yeah,
that's probably like, if I don't see Busta Rhymes, I'm probably, you know, you're halfway to a good review right there.
Yeah. And also, Jamie Lee Curtis's character, Laurie Strode, has actually been killed off twice in the series. So she's been killed off screen in part 5. Part 4, they talk about her being killed off. And on screen in part 8.
8, yeah.
Yeah, so it got me thinking, is there any horror series that has stuck to any rigid continuity? I'm wondering if there's any horror series that has really... this is the most egregious example that I can think of mainstream horror that's really leapt around. But
yeah, I mean, I guess I'm thinking, obviously, we did the Friday the 13th franchise recently. Until 8, we were in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
But then 9 is a real, like, it messes with things. And then 10 is, like, ignores the other one. It's like, here we are again.
And one film that tortured my childhood, The Omen.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great year.
It is, yeah. Do you also know that Jodie Foster made 5 films in 1976?
No way.
Yeah. Freaky Friday, A Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane, Echoes of Summer, which is the only one I've never heard of.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Bugsy Malone and Taxi Driver.
It's incredible.
It's nuts.
That's the work rate of the girl, eh?
Yeah, but also, you know, especially Freaky Friday, Bugsy Malone, and Taxi Driver, like, they're still watched, probably. I mean, obviously Taxi Driver is, but the other ones as well.
Man, it seems like almost overworked.
Yeah.
I would have thought, for a child.
For 13 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the labor laws were a bit before.
A little off.
Yeah.
Yeah, so look, as Duncan said, Carrie and The Omen were the horror heavy hitters of 76. The first, a solid Brian De Palma film that kicked off an endless cycle of Stephen King adaptations. And the second, a wonderfully crafted satanic horror film that kicked off a seemingly endless series of schoolyard discussions about how that one guy really died in that one scene. Maybe the dude who gets his head chopped off, you know, and it's covered by five different cameras. Or maybe the guy who gets cut in half by an out-of-control lift in the second film. Or maybe it's the poor woman attacked by ravens who then stumbles into the path of an oncoming truck.
Yeah.
I remember somebody arguing that that was the one. She really, like, the ravens was planned, but the truck was just next.
Yeah. I just love how you could just basically make snuff films back in the 70s and then just release them and they just become lauded as.
Well, apparently, yeah. And snuff sequels, too. It's like, we're doing it again. And you know, there's no internet. We didn't know any better. We just had to trust our schoolyard chums. You know?
I vividly remember that one with the dude getting decapitated by this pane of glass. Yeah,
that was the one most frequently cited, I believe.
Yeah. Although it's clearly just a mannequin head flying.
Oh,
over it.
Totally. And it's like five cameras rolling. I mean, that can't be an accident. So
what is the idea of keeping this?
What a cruel thing to do to his family too, and just release it and you know
for your consideration at the Oscars.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Simon, we really need to talk about The Predator.
Oh, I have not seen The Predator, so you go.
Okay, well, I finally got to see Shane Black's love letter to himself, and I'm about to ask the question, is this the worst Predator film?
Whoa.
Yeah, obviously it doesn't beat the original, and the Danny Glover sequel clearly has it licked. Even the Robert Rodriguez-produced Predators had a clearer story and more suspense. I dare say Predator versus Alien might fancy its chances against this installment. And, oh yeah, I forgot about Alien versus Predator Requiem. That might be fighting this Predator for last spot. Like, to be honest, Requiem probably is worse. But there is something muddled and forced about this whole movie. It is lacking any suspense at all. And for all its apparent action credentials, it's devoid of a big climactic fight. Like, it's just, you expect this fight to happen and it's over like that. And you're like, really? That's it? There's little stalking from the title character and annoyingly some self-satisfied script work about the accuracy of calling it The Predator. Like, they have this kind of whole meta conversation about, well, it shouldn't be a predator because the predator is actually blah, 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 blah. I'm just like, I don't care about this. This is a running joke that is like so scripted.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't even believe that human beings talk this way. In between some dodgy race jokes and the seemingly arbitrary reasons for getting Olivia Munn naked, the film decides the only one thing to take seriously is that autistic children, apparently, are the next step in the evolutionary chain.
Right.
It's the kind of plot device that stops the viewer in their tracks. Like, yeah, I was like, is this character saying this or do you think this, Shane Black? Well, I think Shane Black thinks it because they doubled down on it by building the Predator's modus operandi around trying to capture the autistic child of the hero.
Yeah.
But aside from all this, the original Predator had macho asshole characters and dodgy jokes. But by God, John McTiernan respected the audience's thirst for suspense.
Yeah.
He built up the atmosphere, something that the 2010 film shrewdly mimicked to its advantage, I thought, in the beginning anyway, at least.
I didn't mind that film.
Yeah, I think it kind of descended a little bit towards the end of it, but I thought the setup was interesting and you were at least intrigued as to what was going on.
Sure.
And that just never exists in this film.
Yeah.
And McTiernan in the original used Arnie's literal strength as a measuring stick.
Mm.
So Arnie was finally and believably outmatched by something. And really, when you think about it, that had never happened in a film up to that point. And I don't know if it ever happened after that.
Yeah.
Like maybe Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, or maybe T2.
Yeah.
Like, but no one had ever maybe outsmarted him, but not out physicaled him. So so what Shane Black seems interested in this is like the mystery. Is it the Dirty Dozen of PTSD soldiers he seems loath to dispatch? Like, you can tell he doesn't want to kill them. You can tell that he thinks these guys are hilarious. Is it the journey of an evolutionary outstanding autistic boy? Like, is that where we're going? Delivering a touching family story, like it's Close Encounters of the Third Kind of. But the biggest killer for me is that the film has zero suspense or surprise. Again, I go back to that because it's really, it's just got nothing inventive in it, really. Save for the guy getting his legs chopped off by the Predator's ship's shield, like, igniting in the final act. That's right. Pretty cool, I got to admit. But man, it was just, it was actually tough to get through. And I'm a Predator fan. As I said to you, Predator, this may be travesty to people, to listeners, but Predator is actually my favorite Arnie film to watch. I don't think necessarily is best, but it's my favorite one to watch. So I've always had a lot of affinity for Predator, and I actually even really enjoy Predator 2, and then after that it's pretty much all downhill. But
yeah, for sure.
This was just, I don't know what this film is trying to be. And you saw the original trailer, right, with the, with this kid.
I was so confused.
I was like, what is this?
Yeah, what was going on with that trailer, eh?
Yeah, it was like Stranger Things, but without any of the charm.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Stranger Things was genuinely more suspenseful than anything in this film.
Right. Wow, that's scathing, man.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not like I've heard anything good to counteract that, but yeah.
No, but I hadn't heard anything scathing either. I hear people pretty much either shrug their shoulders or go, oh, yeah, it's fun. It's big, goofy, dumb fun.
Yeah, no, I remember a friend of the show, the Baron Devon, hating it, I think.
Oh, right.
From memory. Yeah. Unless I'm,
oh, well, it's good to see Baron Devon and I agreeing on something.
Yeah. I might have remembered incorrectly, but I'm pretty certain he did not care for this.
I went with How to Get Ahead in Advertising. So Richard E. Grant reteams with his Withnail and I director in this often forgotten satirical comedy. Grant plays Bagley, a gun advertising executive who can't seem to break through on a simple pimple cream cell. Instead, he starts to question the ethics of his profession, and then slowly the parasite appears. The parasite in this case is a boil that appears on Grant's neck. And in one creepily unforgettable sequence, it develops an eye and a mouth that starts whispering cynicism and dark thoughts, eventually growing into a fully formed second head. So he looks like Zaphod Beeblebrox out of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
Grant's dual performance as Bagley and his inner demons is a tour de force, where he is ostensibly acting across from nothing for large chunks of the movie. In fact, Jim Carrey went up to him during the latest Oscar parties and said, comedy genius what you did in this film from like 1989.
Wow.
And Richard Grant told that story
on a
chat show. But it is The Parasite which is so memorable, a disturbing comic creation voiced by the writer-director Bruce Robinson himself. The boil is full of hatred for his fellow man, seeing them as foolish sheep who are simply vessels for commodity consumption. Bagley's goodwill is not strong enough to fight off the gleeful, lustful misanthropy of the boil. The Parasite is a terrifying presence because it is our inner cynicism manifest, and it will slowly destroy you, making you watch as it takes over your life. But the Parasite isn't just taking over a human being. He is on a mission of religious zeal to mainline pure advertising into the world until its mass marketed to Jerusalem is built on England's green and pleasant lands.
Oh, my goodness. I haven't seen this film.
Yeah, it's pretty much given away the whole film. But,
yeah, that's all right.
It's pretty amazing, and certainly was one out of the box. I mean, obviously, I was a massive Withnail and I fan in my late teenage years, so I ate this up because it was the only film that they did again together. And it's really pretty dark, and another one of those ones where you're like, man, it's kind of gets under your skin a little bit. Pardon the pun.
Yeah.
And the most unevenly toned film I saw as a child, the weird mix of cheesy and gory, a film which idealizes and demonizes lions. Raw. It was sold as a comedy. It calls it a ferocious comedy as a tagline.
Whoa.
But the climax is about as sedate as like straw dogs. As lions maul poachers in visceral attacks, and the resolution sees a hero conspiring to cover up a death in order to protect the lions. I saw this at the film. Bear in mind, I wasn't allowed to see Clash of the Titans because, you know, there's swords and sorcery. Oh. It's like, oh, maybe don't go see that.
Monsters.
But then Roar was like, oh, it's a comedy and it's lions and stuff. And the end of this film is, again, another one I haven't seen since I was like 7 years old.
Yeah.
It's a legendary film as well, apparently. Yeah, a lot of people, life-changing injuries, 70 injuries or something on this thing. Tippi Hedren starred in it with her daughter, Melanie Griffith.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow, you've seen it.
Wow. I saw it at the movies, So, yeah, this was probably like my fifth or sixth film I saw at the movies.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Ferocious comedy.
Ferocious.
Look, to paraphrase a famous Russian playwright, you don't show us a meticulously built... you don't show us a meticulously built underground tunnels in Act 1 without an act three, turning them into vast tracks of epically lethal booby traps. So introduced early on as what I like to call Chekhov's tunnels. Rambo has carved out these tunnels beneath his farmhouse. Here I'm going to apply a psychological reading as the tunnels represent Rambo's mind. Long, dark, subterranean labyrinth that he obsessively tends to, his self-made prison built of torturous memories that forever haunt him. And at the end, they exploded, caving in as Rambo emerges back into the sunlight.
Man, maybe this film will be revisited in years to come, yeah, and the psychoanalyst will apply that sort of reading to it.
I'm pretty certain he's going to come across, like, you know, The Searchers, basically.
That, maybe. Possibly. Look, I'm sure we're going to get to, like, the message of the film, the themes, if you will, if you like. Mm. But before we do, I'm going to try and imagine a kind of morally neutral version of this film.
Good luck.
Yeah, and review it like that. Just in case anyone accuses me of being some left-wing snowflake beater cuck. let's imagine instead of Mexicans, this was Rambo versus Robots. A film I'd probably rather watch, by the way.
Yeah.
But, you know, morally neutral robots.
Okay.
Well, it would still be a terrible film. As a piece of filmmaking, Last Blood's biggest crime is that it has no suspense. Nothing happens in Last Blood that you don't see coming a mile away, like the tunnels we were introduced at the beginning. Mm. You see those tunnels, and they're dug for one reason.
Yeah.
When Gabrielle announces she wants to find her dad in Mexico, you know she's going, no matter what Rambo says. You know that everyone she meets in Mexico will be horrible, like Rambo said, and you know that he will go after her. No surprises so far. You won't be surprised that Rambo isn't killed when he's captured, or that he wants revenge, or that the revenge meted out will take place in the network of tunnels that exists for no other reason than to be the final act in a revenge film. There are no twists in this film. There are no shocking discoveries or characters who surprise you with their actions. It's not exactly a roller coaster of a film. It's more of a log flume ride where instead of water, there's lots of blood, and the log is made out of simplistic racial stereotypes, careening towards my rapidly collapsing metaphor. One of the things that this film has in its favour, I felt, is the best big man in the movies at the moment. Dave Bautista, not as charismatic as The Rock, perhaps, or as iconic as Arnie in his day. He is the best performer of them all, in some ways. He's obviously a beast in the action scenes, leaping across tables, firing to the hip, or knifing his way through a horde of the undead. But he's also the best part of the more dramatic scenes, bringing empathy to the drama of the touchy father-daughter relationship, or the out-of-nowhere confession of a romantic interest. And that's a blessing, because these are the parts of the film I like the least. You know, Dave stealing scenes from his castmates made them better than they deserved, because really, they weren't written with an ear for originality, and could and should probably have been delivered on the run, I think. You know, I often think films like The Terminator, where so much exposition comes out of action scenes, you know? And yet Army of the Dead has to sort of grind to a halt so that people can talk about their feelings. And as you said, this is a 2.5-hour film. It's too long. Not, I felt, ultimately problematically long for me, because I pretty much enjoyed it, but it didn't need to be 2.5 hours. No. And these scenes are the ones that kind of really kill that momentum.
Oh, totally. Look, I think Snyder does a disservice to Ella Purnell. Turning the moral center of the film into a preachy bore who just confronts every character and gets a damp squib of a scene, which I thought with their father, that reveals an unconvincing motivation for their acrimonious relationship. Like, yeah. I didn't think that they did that very well, that the actual reason for their split. I was like, really, that's it? And I actually kind of thought, I've got the reverse view, I actually thought it was an uncomfortable-looking Dave Bautista is just being continually ambushed by women wanting to tell him how emotionally he stunted he is in the middle of, like, icing zombies. It's like, can we have this conversation when there's not a nuke coming in like, hordes of zombies around us?
Believe me, I think the scenes are problematic. I think they're problematically written, but I think Dave deals with them pretty well.
I don't know. I just kind of thought that. I think he's a lot of things. He's predictably good in Spectre. He's surprisingly good in Blade Runner 2049. But I actually thought that this kind of, unfortunately, his lack of range is showing up here. I don't know if he gives that much to the actresses when they're, and I don't know if it's written that way. Mm. But I think an actor with more capability would probably interpret those scenes and those monosyllabic kind of retorts a little bit more nuance or something, I don't know, but you give it a little bit more. But he's just far more at home destroying the zombies, which is just a joy to watch, you know, him slice through around pokey machines and jumping off roulette tables.
Running along the roulette tables, I think. Yeah. It's in the trailer, but it's a great little moment. It's real fun.
Oh, it's great. And, those, as you rightly point out, as a kind of an Arnie or a Rock action guy, I'm like, yeah, this is great. You know, he's great. You know, and he's a believable leader of people, you know, I'd imagine. Yeah, of course. If I'm there, I'm going to be following Dave Bautista. I just stick a little bit closer than anyone else. I feel like, basically.
Hey, his daughter, too, she should have put more clothes on.
Why are you not wearing arm guards? Why is no one
these
wearing arm guards?
These things bite you, and that makes you into a zombie. And she's going in wearing like a singlet.
Yeah.
Sleeveless.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people were a little underdressed, but she was criminally underdressed. And there was a moment there before they went in where he could have said, look, grab a jacket.
Yeah.
Something leathery, some gloves or something. Just before we go, just dress up a little more.
I just wish in a film, like, these guys almost have, like, body armor on at points where it's like they've kind of got, like, oh, in case I get shot or something, like, around their chest and stuff. But then they have all these bare arms. And it's only the arms. No one's ever getting bitten in the leg. It's always the arms.
Yeah, totally.
Crazy.
Yeah, or the neck sometimes, and that kind of neck, upper shoulder area, you know, when you get surprised zombied.
Yeah. You know. I'd just be wearing, like, a knight's armor, you know what I mean, into these things.
I wouldn't let my daughter be going in.
No.
You know.
Oh, just try and stop her, Simon. Just try and stop her.
She's wearing a tank top. I mean, she should have had known better, right?
Oh, well.
I mean, she lives there. She lives, like, on the outskirts. Yeah.
Are you blaming her for what she's wearing, Simon?
What's...
Wow.
Yeah, no daughter of mine is going into Las Vegas. Look, there's a lot of... I'm moving on real quickly.
Yeah, pretty quickly.
I think you're getting me in trouble.
I'm putting words in your mouth, have I, Simon?
Spoiler alert. Hey, so thanks everyone for tuning in and listening to our 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years, especially if you have actually been there for 10 years, like listening to all it, or is, you know, even 7 or 8 years, you know, like we really appreciate it. We appreciate anyone listening, getting involved on Facebook and talking to us and laughing along with our jokes.
100%.
So what's the song we're going out to, Simon?
Okay, so we're going out to I Feel Love. This is the cover of the Donna Summer song, and it's from The Lure. It's one of the first songs you hear in the movie, actually. I think it's maybe second song in. And I hope you enjoy that. Check out The Lure, actually. It's kind of wild. And tune in next month because it's October, which is Halloween. And so we're going to do a deep dive into the Hammer Studio.
Yes, well, I'm really looking forward to this, listeners. I'll tell you that much, because a lot of you might be like me and fairly a bit like a neophyte, whereas Simon's very much an acolyte of of horror, especially Hammer. So I think if I've seen any, it's generally when I've been a kid. It's probably on like the Sunday horrors when I was like, shouldn't have been watching them. I have never gone out and hunted these ones out, so I will really be coming to all of these with fresh eyes. I probably haven't seen any of these, and if I have, like I said, it was just pure accident. So I'm really looking forward to checking these ones out as well and take the journey along with you, Simon. And
cool.
You can lead us along.
This was my gateway, I would say, my gateway drug into the whole horror scene is watching these Sunday night, staying up past Radio Pictures so I could get some, Technicolor goo from Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. So I'm really excited to revisit them as well and go back into that world for a month. It's going to be good fun.
That's going to be great, especially leading up to Halloween. It's going to be
excellent. Yes, 100%. So take care, everyone.
See you next month.
Action thrillers like Patriot Games, Lethal Weapon, and Die Hard always score big with audiences. And Livewire is the next explosive hit. It's loaded with non-stop action, stunts and special effects. And it's available in rated and unrated versions.